And then I have my allies around there so they didn't see you.
Today's February 7th, 2017. This is a Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on Human Services. It's a continuation of our informational meeting orientation from yesterday. As I was kind of thinking about yesterday, I thought it would be, instead of having everybody raise their hands to be kind of called on, I thought it was a little bit better when it was kind of conversational. So if you guys want to interject and have questions in the moment, let's not treat this as like a normal committee hearing, but kind of as a conversation with staff. I think it'll be a little bit easier just to kind of chime in and stop in the moment so that we don't have to go back a couple of slides as we did yesterday, I thought. So Linda and Lori, do you guys want to, I think we're on page 22, if you guys are looking at the slides there in the audience. For those watching on TV, we have a big audience packed here in the Human Services Subcommittee today.
Oh, and it may be worth mentioning that the actual materials on OLIS are on yesterday, since it's all one presentation.
All right. Please let the record reflect that Ms. Cowling came in late today. But we do appreciate her attendance on orientation day.
We're serious about starting on time here.
Right. So, if you'd like, as the chair said, we left off in the middle of this presentation yesterday, and we had just talked about what some of the categories were, expenditure categories in the budget, and that was on slide 21. And then, just as a follow-up, we did send you a little bit more information on one of the slides from yesterday. There was a report. We tried to do some crosswalking of some of the elements on there for you to look at. And if you have any questions about that, you can talk to Linda or I about that detail. And you'll see more of those reports as we get into work sessions towards the end of session. So this next document that we've got for you is an example of what's called a budget report spreadsheet. So one of the final documents that comes out with the agency's budget bill is a budget report. And for a budget bill, that's the same as a fiscal impact statement on a policy bill. So it's the equivalent of that. There's a narrative document, and what goes along with that is a spreadsheet. I wanted to give you an example because this is where you see some of that information about expenditures by category and some of the materials you'll look at. So this is an example, again, from the Long-Term Care Ombudsman, which is a smaller agency that comes before the committee. And this spreadsheet will show you what the adjustments were in the budget bill for that agency last long session. And you'll see within that document that we break out some of the elements by categories like personal services and services and supplies. And personal services is where you'll see the positions and full-time equivalent positions associated with personnel actions. So that's just kind of give you some context. Halfway down that document, it says package 801 LFO analyst adjustments. You'll see down in there, we provide some lower level detail on services and supplies adjustments if those are relevant or pertinent to the conversation. So you can see that there were specific adjustments made to certain line items as part of that final budget process. So we do get into some of the details as we move through the budget process. So I'll go on to the next slide unless there are questions. Back on, but more, so a little bit more on budget process. So appropriation bills are the budgetary control, as we talked yesterday. Each agency in Oregon will have a budget bill they start off with. There can be adjustments made above and beyond that, but there's a primary budget bill for each agency. Those budget bills go into what's called session law. So you won't find budget bills in Oregon revised statutes. You have to go back to session law to find that actual budgetary adjustment if you're looking at prior history. The appropriation bills themselves are not detailed at that expenditure category level I just showed you. They're high-level dollars. They're by fund type. So, for example, for the Long-Term Care Ombudsman, there will be a general fund dollar amount in that budget bill. There will be an other funds expenditure limitation amount and potentially a federal funds limitation amount if that agency has that funding source. The other thing I didn't mention yesterday is from a structural standpoint. So there's expenditures we don't talk about within the agency budget. We also have structures within the agency itself. So for example, in the Department of Human Services, big agency, it has a big overall budget, but we break that budget down for discussion purposes. So when that agency comes before the subcommittee, they'll talk about discrete programs. They'll talk about child welfare. They'll talk about self-sufficiency. And there is a mirrored budget structure that matches up with that program, right? So you'll be looking at those program chunks in a broken out way as we move through the process. And we'll also make recommendations on those budgets and those chunks. And within smaller agencies, you'll have breakouts as well. So there's a structure within just the expenditures that let you kind of piece things apart and look at some of the large budgets and chunks. As I mentioned, the appropriation bills are by fund type. Budget reports provide information on the budget, but don't have the force of law. The law is really the dollar amounts that are put into those budget bills. And then budget notes are directives within the budget report. And sometimes, as Linda mentioned yesterday, those are a tool to help set the stage for some reporting that the agency might provide in the future, or for some expectations around maybe an investment in the budget, expectations around what those outcomes should be, or some reporting back to the subcommittee. The next slide on page 24 is an example of an appropriation bill. So this is, again, the appropriation bill for the Long-Term Care Ombudsman from last session. It's a smaller agency. It's a shorter bill. It fits on the slide, which is why I provided you that. So you'll see that it breaks out a couple of general fund components, and then section 2 of the bill deals with other funds revenue, and in this case, or other funds expenditures. In this case, the other funds expenditures primarily come from federal funds that go to the Department of Human Services and the Older Americans Act program and get sent to Long-Term Care Ombudsman to fund that program. Again, one of those funding conversion things we talked about yesterday. The next slide, here's a couple of examples of a budget note. The first budget note is really long, but these are actual budget notes from last session. So the first budget note is one for the Department of Human Services about sustainability in the aging and people with disability and intellectual and development disability programs. It's pretty lengthy. It's got some direction there, some reporting requirements, and some expected actions. And then the second budget note is specific to the Public Employees Benefit Board, which is part of the Oregon Health Authority budget. I just wanted to show you what budget notes might look like. For the large agencies, it's not unusual to have at least one or two over the course of the session, but again, we don't want a budget note every aspect of the budget, or we would never get through it. So keep that in mind moving forward. Budget process detail. Again, appropriation bills are in the 5,000 series, and House bills, Senate bills in the 5,500 series. So if you see a bill that starts with a 5, you know it's a budget-related bill. There's about 90 agencies, so there's about that many budget bills. A few more because we have a handful of omnibus bills. Agencies range from very small to very large. We have the budgets for bonding and capital construction bills are put in separate vehicles. Capital construction expenditure limitations are 6-year limitations, so they're tracked a little bit differently, a little bit separately from regular 2-year expenditure limitations. Appropriation bills can only deal with basically those budget numbers. So that's what's in there. If we have other budget-related actions that need to be developed or put into law as part of the budget process, those will need to be in a policy bill or in what we typically call a program change bill that will help implement some budget adjustments in over the whole budget process. So typically that's a combined bill. And then at the end of that last bullet talks about that usually we have a couple bills at the end of session. One is that program change bill that has the statutory change I just mentioned, and the emergency fund / Christmas tree / omnibus final reconciliation bill that will usually contain statewide adjustment-related items as well as potentially some additional budget expenditures that are allowed to be implemented late in the session as the final revenue numbers are made available. Next slide, subcommittee roles and responsibilities. As we talked about some yesterday, I think we talked about this quite a bit actually in the initial materials for the committee. This subcommittee will review agency budgets. We'll have a series of presentations. The first phase is really informational for you to get information about how programs work, how they're funded, what the dynamics around cost controls and expenditures are for those programs. And phase 2 we'll get into a little bit more detail for some of the large agencies. And then phase 3 is really that final recommendation action on the budget bill. You'll see budget reports as they come out of the process. The subcommittee does not receive the budget report. It receives work session recommendations from the analysts. Then a budget report is prepared and sent as part of the full committee process. So the budget report does not come before the subcommittee, but gets developed and put together before it goes to the full committee, and that's what goes with the bill to the floors. Okay, mentioned budget notes, federal grants. We already know we have some grants on the agenda coming up for the Oregon Health Authority. The Public Health Division in particular is very active in the grant arena.
It is the grant season.
It's grant season.
So a number of days here, we'll have to, at the end of our day, take 10 minutes to hear a grant. And they actually require a vote and go to the full committee in order for the agency to be allowed to request permission to apply.
And that is a statutory requirement, that there's permission to apply grant by the legislative body. Further, again, we talked about reports. We might have some reports that are required by budget note or for some other purpose that come before the committee. Sometimes an agency will have a report that goes before a substantive committee, and that same report might come here because there was a need or desire to have that report before the budget committee. We may have some informational hearings. Sometimes there's topics that come up in later in session, and we want to have a broader conversation around a particular policy issue or budget-related item. Fee-related bills, I think Linda mentioned that we know Oregon Health Authority has a fee ratification bill, which has to do with ratifying fees that were increased by a rule. Many agencies have fees that are authorized to be modified under a rulemaking process, but then those have to be approved through a ratification process by the legislative body. And as mentioned yesterday, there should be some policy bills that come before the subcommittee probably later in the session.
I have a quick question. Going back to federal grants.
Uh-huh.
Did you say that we had to get permission to apply for federal grants, and are those new federal grant opportunities or existing federal grant opportunities?
Typically, the requests that come over the committee are new competitive opportunities that the federal government announces. We have, so in terms of grant, we have a lot of ongoing federal funding streams that we don't treat as competitive grants. For example, the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families program, that's an ongoing federal grant. We don't treat Medicaid funding as a grant. It's typically a very specific announcement for a very specific thing that the federal government puts out, and the agencies have to actually apply, do a bunch of paperwork, and compete for funds with other states or entities. So it's usually a very specific item that comes before the subcommittee. But those ongoing federal funding sources, we don't treat as a federal grant under that permission process.
Okay. And it's only
inherently, by approving the federal funds in the budget for those big programs, it's been approved tacitly. So,
thank you.
So here, the next few slides are presenting some high-level statewide budget information, and the context for these slides is really the current biennium budget. As we move forward to 17-19,
can I ask a quick question? Sorry to interrupt. Before you get on to a new topic, so it surprised me in my first session to find that the fiscal analysis just focuses on the cost side and not the potential savings when you analyze the fiscal implications of a bill.
Depending on the on a bill, sometimes there are cost savings.
Right.
But I would say that at least in my personal experience, most of what I see come through a bill usually costs money.
It's usually something
new.
Okay.
But there can be, for example, we have suspended in the Department of Human Services. There were some statutory requirements around the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families program that were put in place two or three biennia ago, and those have been temporarily suspended, and that has been continuing. And by doing that, we've had lower spending levels in some parts of the budget. So there are some things that happen that do suppress those costs, but usually new legislation is more the other direction.
Yeah,
is there a specific example you're thinking of?
Yeah, I could give you several, but
okay.
But why not? I mean, I've never seen in the fiscal analysis, it's always on how much it costs and not a net of cost versus cost savings.
If there are savings, we typically try to identify it as part of that analysis. And what's in the fiscal analysis will only be cost to government. So sometimes there are.
Why? Because you could have the policy could have a savings to government. It could cost a little bit up front, but save in year two or three as.
And
so why don't you do projections that's a net?
And I would say that we try to do that. So without a specific example to look at, I'm a little bit lost on that.
Okay. It's an interesting.
Well, I'll give you an example. I mean, the birth control bill that Senator Steiner Hayward and I championed last time, it essentially increased access to oral hormone birth control, which is known to decrease unintended pregnancies, which certainly is a big cost driver in the Medicaid budget. And it was just.
And there was no savings associated with that?
Right. I mean, I think the real answer is that you have a two-year budget, which is kind of like almost a cash flow in that immediate two-year, and we have a certain amount of money that the budget has to be balanced. So we have to know what the fiscal is for that two-year period. And in the bienniums after that, from a policy perspective, we're going to see savings from something like that, which would then be reflected once we get into that biennium.
But I think
it's only 9 months,
right,
since birth.
But I also think if I may, Mr. Chair, I think Representative Buehler brings up a valid point, because we do see, for example, projections about what the revenue impacts might be on subsequent biennia. When we look at revenue impact statements, we do see what the revenue is going to be in this biennium, and we see revenue impact statements for subsequent biennia. And when we see fiscal impact statements, we see this is what the cost for this biennium, but the roll-up cost for the subsequent biennia. So I'm not as confident in that rationale that you put forward, and I think Representative Buehler brings forward a good point, because as we face the budget challenge that we're looking at today, one of the things that I personally feel strongly that this committee and, frankly, all subcommittees are charged with is thinking about how to prevent us from being in at least as bad position, if not worse, 2 years from now. And one of the ways we do that is to make substantive investments in areas that cost us money now but save us money in the long term, right? Early childhood services, for example. Right. Evidence-based early childhood services save us money in the long term.
Yeah. One of the most difficult to do, and it's been a discussion that's been in this building for a lot of years, and particularly those programs are activity that's, unquote, on the prevention side. Mm-hmm. And to get enough data or science to actually prove that, yes, what was put forth actually did, number one, save money, number two, prevent it. Mm-hmm. That, whether you're talking about early childhood and did really early childhood, because it takes so long in order to get the data and the results out to really validate the hypothesis. And so that's one of the issues. And so, we weren't set up years ago, and I don't think, you know, even now, unless the author of the bill actually has enough into that bill that then can say to staff, you know, within a two-year period, we should be able to have saved X amount of dollars. We should be able to, because of. And that's been a real challenge. It's been a real challenge, particularly on the social science side.
Yeah. And I totally get where
you're at. Yeah, please.
Senator, I totally get what you're saying from a lot of firsthand. But not to have that at least somewhere in the analysis. I mean, even if you, and I get also Representative Rayfield's point too, that it's we're dealing with cash here, right? We're not dealing with projected revenue. We have to balance in this biennium. But to not have that in a form that we can at least analyze, and you could do a sensitivity analysis, say, okay, to speak to the senator's point, you know, okay, assuming this amount of, you know, prevention all the way to potentially this high end of prevention, here's the potential range of cost savings. And I just think it's really, and I know it put a big burden on LRO staff, but I think, or LFO staff, but I think it'd be important data to have, especially as we start to look at making cuts probably this session, is, you know, we want to be smart about those cuts and not cut those places where we're going to save dollars down the road from investments in year zero.
These are the type of things that we, you know, we have looked at in a policy complex, but there isn't like firm numbers because the science is not exactly accurate. And so from a long-term perspective, what is the investment, as Senator Winters mentioned, when you invest in this year over the 10 years, and then that guides how you're going to invest with the current dollars that we have, especially when there's an opportunity cost between putting money in one place and putting it in another. And I think that is the lens that everybody on this committee is already interested in doing. I think the tough part for LFO is, you know, there's a staffing issue, and really the, you know, and how do you develop those numbers, and I think which gets informed from a lot of the advocates in this space kind of helping us inform those types of decisions.
To play devil's advocate, or perhaps to just pile on with what Representative Buehler is saying, I think one of the things, I just saw a study actually from the Pew States, which is pretty reputable. It says Oregon is one of the country's leaders in using evidence-based policy, right? We're in the top four states in the nation, which is great, and that makes me very happy to hear, which means we're not doing a bunch of random stuff that doesn't have the evidence behind it, where we don't know what the ROI is for specific investments. Of course, you have to implement exactly right or pretty close to right, and of course, there's a range of potential there, But I think it's a valid point, and I think it's something that within reason this committee ought to be keeping in mind, and I'm grateful to Representative Buehler for bringing up the point, because we've got to be sure that if we're making cuts, we make the right ones, and if we're making investments, we're making the right ones.
You know, it would be very nice, and some of us have wanted this for a long time. Washington does have the ability to do cost-benefit analysis, and that's what you're talking about.
That's one of the things we hope to do.
And so, you know, and the question became whether or not, you know, like Washington, it is an independent operation that is not within side of the body of government in order so that you're actually getting a fair and balanced result back, and some of us have actually, you know, have proposed that creation, and of course dollars and cents always comes into play as to whether or not we go forward in creating another entity, and should that entity be attached to Willamette. I mean, there has been this discussion in this building of that particular need. But whether, you know, I think for LFO and LFOs, you know, with their staffing limitability and some of the others, we just have never gotten to that level. I mean, to be honest with you.
And I think, I don't think anybody disagrees that that's what, you know, we should be doing. We're having a conversation type thing. So today we're not doing the formal committee stuff, so just feel free to chime in.
Jump in.
Yeah. And I don't think anybody disagrees with this approach to do. I think if, you know, we would have to look at appropriating some additional money to LFO to be able to come up with that analysis and have, like, there is a practicality. And so right now the way we have been doing it is using kind of the institutional knowledge of stakeholders to kind of put that information together, and there are a lot of people, and even when I met with you personally, I told you this is the direction we should be going, is actually looking at the 10-year investments, and so I think that's how, I think every, and even the Senator Steiner Hayward, these are the directions that we want to go in, but we're going to have to do it with the resources that we have at the moment, not saying that in the future we couldn't do things like that, but that is going to be in this biennium, I think we're going to have to use our, you know, the best information that we have to make those decisions kind of in a looking at that, how that money gets invested over a 10-year period. So what are the results, right? The return on investment.
So I had a question, one thought on that, not to get away from it, but it would definitely give us more to discuss, and maybe you want to protect us from that, trying to evaluate whether those projections would actually come to place or not. But one thing that I've wondered about is there is a way to kind of qualify or quantify the effects on our partners, the counties. And the counties are often saying, "What is this? How is this going to affect us?" And so they work, and of course they're short-staffed, LFO, everybody's short-staffed, trying to figure that out. But why isn't there a category in these fiscal analysis of what the effect to maybe an average county? I know it would be very difficult to do 36 counties, but based on population to a county, or something that gives us an idea of what the cost effect to the counties are rather than just the state budget.
Well, so first of all, back to the initial comment, there should be no reason, even if we can't quantify savings, there could still be a statement about it's expected to over time achieve savings, and that should be definitely be part of the analysis. So if we're not covering that, we should be. Just like if we know something's going to be implemented in the short term, but that we think the long-term cost is going to be growing, we'll note that. So even if we can't put a number on it, there should still be some kind of explanation about the dynamics behind what direction things are going. We do ask the counties in the fiscal process for feedback on impacts on legislation. They do respond to our office, and to the extent which we get any information from the counties, we'll try to include that. But I will say that does depend on the issue, and kind of if it's a bill that the counties are tracking closely and they want to report on, we don't go out to individual counties. We do rely on the association to primarily collect and provide that information. So there should be, if we've got it, something about counties in there. Frequently, it's not super specific. It may not be a dollar amount, but there should be some, at least, discussion about what we think the impacts to counties and local governments will be from legislation.
But you're not required to track that down or put that in there. Well, you just try to.
I don't know if the statute speaks to that we have to ask them for feedback. I know we do that in the process, but there's no requirement that says we have to come up with a number on every bill that relates to local government needs. And again, we rely on other folks to provide us that information to try and filter it. And if we were to try and go out there and start quantifying that on behalf of counties, that would be probably a very different workload.
Yeah.
And I would like to add from a program perspective, I know we're not doing policy here, but I've done direct service in programming. Not all bills actually require you to track data. So that's maybe something that we need to add to bills. So that is captured in the programming aspect. So then that we can come back and talk about whether how successful it was, because not all bills have that requirement. Therefore, counties are not going to always have that data. They may reach out to the programs themselves, and those programs might say, well, we can provide you some general information, but we don't have the funding to track that information. So it's really, I think, dependent on each individual bill. And if there's funding to support that bill in tracking data, then there's going to be funding to support the data researchers to do that analysis. So then we can have that information.
Really good point.
All right.
Onward. Shall we talk about this lovely pie chart?
So, I would love to.
So this is some context for sort of where the budget is in the current biennium, just kind of give you a feel for where things land. So this is a total funds budget, which means it's all the money, general, lottery, other funds, and federal funds in the budget. So you will see that federal funds is a very large chunk of the statewide budget, 32%. General funds about 25%, and other funds is around 41%. Lottery funds, a very small slice. That's just to give you kind of some context for at the statewide level, where the money in the budget is, and we really focus a lot in this budget process on the yellow part, right? That's where a lot of the conversation revolves around, because that's where the fungible resource that we can use for a variety of programs. Then this is the same dollar amount, total funds, but it's split up by program area. So you will see human services as a program area, total funds level, is the biggest component of the budget. But again, a lot of that money is federal money in that piece of the pie. State school fund, 10%, other education, administration, 11%. So again, really, human services is the big player in the total funds budget perspective. General fund and lottery fund only, which is frequently the number we focus on, is that combined total in terms of the statewide budget and the statewide level of resources available for programs. State school fund now is the bigger part of the pie on that chart. That's really where the largest percentage of the state general fund resources are going. Human services, still a big player. Public safety, also a big player. And other education is another chunk of that pie. I don't know why there's not a percentage there for that one. Sorry.
What is that? That's probably 10.
So this is a chart that shows a little bit of budget history for all funds budget. Shows growth over time. Let's see if I had anything to add on that. Again, the next slide is that same slide with only the general fund and lottery funds components listed. If you'll look closely at the side, you will see a couple of down points in that progressive growth. One was in the 2001-03 biennium when we had a dip in revenue, and then again in 2009-11 after the recession when funding was down. So the growth over time has been typically in the percentages of 13%, 15%, 14% from biennium to biennium growth. But that was during the recession, it actually was a decrease of about 5.5% in resources of the state. And that was the last time we were really focused on a budget reduction environment. That's all I wanted to point out about on that overall graph. But again, the trend definitely has been in growth over time, with a couple of exceptions in the economic downturns.
Ms. Byerly, can you clarify one thing for me? It looks to me, it's hard to gauge exactly on this thing, but it looks to me as if lottery funds are decreasing. Is that because lottery funds are being specified more and more for other purposes, or because fewer people are gambling in the lottery?
It doesn't have to do with how they're being dedicated. It has to do with the overall resource. And I just believe there has been some, I'm not an expert on the lottery forecast, but I believe there have been some trends in changes in gaming.
Got it. Thank you.
And I think the lottery has been trying to actively improve that. If you're a fan.
it's a complicated conversation.
It's a mixed thing.
It's a mixed thing.
Next slide, again, back to the total funds budget. This shows how the money's spent at the macro level. So I think we mentioned yesterday that a lot of the money in state government is going out in special payments. So 74% of the budget is going out to providers, to school districts, to individuals in some of the human services programs are getting individual benefits. So a lot of the money is really going out the door to third parties or entities that are providing government services that are not state government agencies directly. And then and the personal services component really is going to pay for state government employees. SNS, again, is the, those operational costs that help support the functions and operations of state government.
Quick question about that. I have read the funds, the positions report that came out from LFO in the fall, but what I don't remember is I know that compared to other states, we actually do pretty well on our number of state employees per capita, right? We're on the lower end of states on positions per capita. What I don't know is, as a percent of state budget, how are we doing? Is 10.4% a good number or a not so good number compared to other states?
I don't have any sense for that, but we can do a little bit of research on that.
I'd be grateful. Thank you.
Total spending per capita is that number's out there compared to other states. Yeah. Pew has a
right. Process. But I'm just thinking, one of the concerns that people raise, and I think legitimately, is to make sure that we right size and have the right number of state employees doing the right things and that we pay them in the right range. And some people think we don't pay our state employees enough, don't think we would say it too much. One of the ways to think about it, it's only part of the question, is whether is the percent spend of our budget. And it's just another piece of data that we can consider.
So you saw some slides that showed how budget grows and changes over time, and some of those drivers behind budget changes include population growth, so again, overall demographics, how many elderly aging people do we have in the state, how many kids do we have in school, how many poor people do we have that need Medicaid and other services. That all drives budgets and changes in the budget. Inflation, how fast are the costs growing that we can't control? Healthcare costs has definitely been part of the conversation. Mandated caseloads. So in the Department of Human Services and in Oregon Health Authority, we do have what are considered mandated caseloads, caseloads that have to be served at least at some program level. So it may be that the caseload needs to be served. There may be ability to tailor the services provided. And so as part of the budget building exercise, we look at those mandated caseloads. The department has a forecasting staff that actually use data to analyze and try to forecast what those caseload counts are going to look like over time. We use that as part of the budget process. Federal policy changes can have a lot of impact on state programs, especially in the programs that are heavily federally funded, which you'll see in human services. Lawsuits, for example, in the intellectual and development disability arena, there was a lawsuit that talked about providing support and employment to people with intellectual and development disabilities. The state was involved in that lawsuit. There's a settlement agreement that requires Department of Human Services to provide services to those clients and work with increase the number of folks in supported employment. That has had a budgetary impact on the department because it costs, it's a different type of service and it costs more money in some instances than what they were doing previously. Initiatives, these can be ballot measures that get passed by the people that drive, or citizens that drive costs for state government that don't always have funding associated with them. And we all know that the public employees retirement system is a cost driver for the state budget, particularly in the area of personal services. Replacement of one-time revenues, that's something you'll hear about this session in this subcommittee, because there are one-time revenue sources that helped support the current biennium budget that are no longer going to be available in 2017-19. So there needs to be a discussion about how best to rectify that, whether it's through reductions or through to find a different resource to put in its place. And state policy decisions. Sometimes we make our state policy decisions or laws are passed that influence the budget down the road, and sometimes those influences are unknown at the time, and sometimes they turn out to be more significant than we might may have thought initially. Back to that fiscal impact statement, the ability to really look into the future and have good information on exactly how programs are going to turn out and what those costs are going to be. There's other things that drive the budget, too, but these are the big ones you're probably going to hear about during the session.
And they're pretty much all in human services.
Yeah, there's not. These are all heavily influenced in these big agency programs. So So budget issues facing the legislature, rebalancing the current biennium budget. Again, I mentioned that we'll probably have a session, a bill during session, that will rebalance that statewide budget as needed, as well as we'll have a bill that address the two large agencies in this subcommittee. The revenue forecast will change. There's a revenue forecast in February and one in May that will provide general fund information about what's available for resources in 2017-18. And we've already identified that there's definitely difficulty in being able to continue current programs and operations based on what we believe the cost of those services are going to be in 2017-19. We know that there's not enough revenue on the table right now. And even while we're in that sort of budget constrained environment, we know that the governor and other stakeholders also have a lot of demands, as well as folks in the body. There are things they want to accomplish that might cost money, and they're trying to prioritize all those issues together and figure out what can go forward versus what can't will be a challenge. Potential lawsuits, there could be more issues on the table that will impact budget. State employee and non-state employee compensation, there are expectations, I think, a lot of times about what those compensation changes will be like in the future, and a lot of pressure to meet some of those expectations. Ballot initiatives were passed that I can have expectations and not always funding to go with them. And then trying to look forward ahead, not necessarily 10 years down the road, but at least in the next two-year cycle, as we're trying to forecast to see what that 2019-21 budget picture is going to look like, especially in the context of what we think this, what's going to happen with the 17-19 budget. Something that has does happen frequently in government and in this legislature is there's a really good idea, and it's kind of expensive, and a bill might get passed or it might get implemented, and we like to backload it. So we might put it in place in the last 6 months, say, of the next biennium, right? Didn't cost that much. It was for a six-month period. But then that new program is now in place for the full length of the next two-year cycle. And so there's a pretty good roll-up sometimes associated with those programs. So that's something to be thinking about in this current environment, is if there's a desire to actually add, what does that future picture look like, and is it really going to be sustainable if we think that future outlook is not looking very positive? So that's, again, demands and expectations sometimes battle with future sustainability and budget issues.
I have a quick question on that. Under the potential lawsuits or potential expenses, under the Affordable Care Act, the federal government has the ability to recoup funds, and one that I've been concerned about is Cover Oregon funds. Does LFO or does the state have any idea where we're at with CMS on that, particularly with the executive order that came out that said that it wouldn't harm funds? Has there been a look at that, or are we still potentially on the hook for $248 million?
Do you know anything on that?
I don't know if there's anything. I mean, I know there's been a lot of discussion about it in various places. I don't know if there's any specific action taking place, or if it's been more of a wait and see. I don't know.
No forgiveness, but no movement forward? Or.
Well, I just know as far as what we've got put together for state budget numbers, we're not building that in as a risk that needs to be covered. Is that correct?
Maybe the attitude is, okay, go ahead and try to collect it.
But there's no document out there.
Not that I'm aware of. Mm-mm. You're looking for something that would have a risk analysis on that particular scenario. Is that what you're thinking?
Yeah, I mean, because if it does happen, that would be significant.
It would. Let me check with OHA and DOJ and see if there's any active discussions going on. Or if there's been any conclusion, but I think we would have heard if there had been a conclusion. I did hear from OHA recently that at this point, CMS has basically told them that their marching orders are to not have any policy discussions with states until they are clearer about what direction they may be taking. So they're not hopeful they're going to get any decisions about really any questions we may have in the near future.
Well, that...
That's reassuring.
That might be good for the Cover Oregon.
That rings like special session to me. But, I mean, if it does come down, you know, I mean, that's a large chunk of money and a concern.
I think one of the things just to keep in mind is the way that that settlement and everything came about. We were the prevailing party in a lot of ways from a legal perspective. So you want to keep that in mind from, in thinking about the risk level. You know, certainly there's always going to be a risk for anything. But just kind of, putting that as a little bit of a context there. So Representative Maelstrom has been waiting to get.
Well, one thing that's been sort of weighing on my mind, and I don't hear anybody talking about, but is this potential Linn County timber lawsuit thing hanging out there. How do you, where does that come into play, or what do we know or do about any of that?
You're talking about, I don't even know what that is.
I do know quite a bit about it.
I thought you might.
Just because that was the last sub I was on, I've sat through some of the summary judgment motions. I would actually just schedule a meeting with ODF. Yeah. Maybe put a half hour, an hour in your schedule for that one. So, yeah.
Well, that's a pretty scary thing looming out there. So,
I think for conversation for here. There's always a lot of moving parts out there in other parts of the state. You know, you mentioned the timber issue, which, not knowing where those dollars would go, whether that's another fund or whatever's happening over there. The majority of what we're doing in DHS is pretty much general and federal funds. If you looked at the budget when Ms. Byerly talked about and looked at that pie chart, you're talking about those pots of money with huge coming in for general fund and federal dollars. If you look at the trend line, you will see in that trend line, where the graphs went up when we made policy decisions to do the health care reform. There's two pieces in there that, we didn't talk about, that and the increase in the amount of federal dollars, which are now on the decrease. The other piece in there that you can see a spike, and I think go back to about 2003, you will see when we did the negotiation for health care with the provider assessment piece, and that was some monies that were at the hospitals were nice enough to contribute so that we could leverage and get additional federal dollars. So I think those are the kinds of things that are inside of this budget that I would ask that you begin looking at those trend lines, because those are the things that will change this session or could have some budgetary implications this session, particularly where the federal dollars begin to decrease, which means that we either have to increase the state portion of it or look at reductions.
Next slide. The next series of slides starts diving back into a little bit more into some budget detail. So back to the budget building process. I mentioned budget instructions yesterday, and we talked about the cycle the agencies use to actually develop their budget that is brought here for review. What you hear about frequently is current service level and what that is and how it's developed. And this is just sort of some bullets talk about what goes into that work product. So Oregon is an incremental budgeting model. We use an incremental budgeting model that basically takes sort of the prior biennium's base as a starting point for the next biennium. Not everyone agrees with that process, but that's what we've got in place right now, what we've been using. So we take that base budget, and there's some adjustments made for personal services. So you'll hear about employee compensation, and you'll hear about COLAs, and you'll hear about step increases. The model that we currently use to develop that personal services costing for the next biennium takes a snapshot of current employees in the spring of an even-numbered year. So in April 2016, a snapshot was taken of employees in positions to see what their salaries were. Those salaries were looked at, and then for agreed to bargained compensation changes that were in place already in the current biennium, those were applied. So there was a COLA that was scheduled for later in the biennium. That was applied to that rate. So then those positions are repriced at whatever that rate, bargained rate, has been in the current biennium and projected for 17-19. So that's something that happens in that base budget building process. There's a snapshot taken, and there's a reprojection of personal services costs. Now, that's based on employees at that time. We know that churned, that changes, people leave, people come, and that amount will change over time, but we fix that as a starting point for budget building process. It doesn't change later. It just stays there. debt service is adjusted, so those debt service schedules are evaluated. If we know the state and agencies are on the hook to pay debt service payments in the next biennium, and those are built into the budget because of obligations we can't get out of. And then program phase-in for the cost of new programs, the example I gave you previously where we had something that was new in the prior biennium, it started late in the biennium, and was only had 6 months of expenditures in the prior biennium, now has to be biennialized at 24 months. That's the kind of thing that gets built in. It was something that was approved, a program that was identified in the current budget, and it's continuing forward without any other statutory changes. I mean, things can be pulled back, but for budget building purposes, it's assumed to still be ongoing. That's built in. Now, for programs that were phased out, sometimes we have a program that goes away. Sometimes we have a project that has limited duration positions or a short term. That gets pulled out of the budget. So there are things that come out as well as things that get rolled up.
If I could add one thing. You should have received yesterday a report on debt service and debt management in this state. It came as a bound copy to your office. And it's worth looking at. If you don't have much experience in tracking how the state manages debt, we actually do a very, very good job of it in this state. And in fact, when interest rates were lower, we managed to refinance a lot of our debt, which saved the state millions and millions and millions of dollars. But it's real, and we have to have debt for certain things. We do it for infrastructure, whether that's physical infrastructure or electronic infrastructure like new IT projects. So it's interesting to understand, and it's an important part of how we manage our funds. We can't borrow, obviously, for ongoing operating expenses because of the balanced budget stuff that Ms. Byerly taught us about yesterday. But we do borrow for important capital investments. So that debt report is pretty useful.
So there's some inflationary factors built into the budget related to service supplies and other expenditures. The factors used in the current process were 3.7% for general types of items and 4.1% for items related to medical expenses.
And remember, that's a two-year increase, not annual. They seem high when you first look at them.
And it's over a two-year process. It's a two-year factor. And then we had, again, where there are mandated caseloads in the budget, those are built in as part of the process as well. And then fund shifts, I mentioned before, sometimes we have one-time funds that were used knowingly in advance that they would not be available for the next biennium. So usually the mechanism to correct that, at least initially in the current service level, is to go ahead and backfill those with general funds if there's no other funding available. Again, that is the cost or the price of continuing the current work going on, even with a different funding mix. But again, current service level is a point in time. It's a control point for review and evaluation. It's not necessarily a given as far as funding. It can be modified. It can be changed. We can talk about how to adjust funding within that. It's not necessarily, it doesn't have to be. I think sometimes there's a perception that current service level has to be funded. It doesn't have to be, but there has to be a discussion about what's not going to be funded within that and what the expectation is around program levels that don't meet current service level. So as a reminder, the budget target for the Department of Human Services is $285 million below current service level. So it will be something that you'll be thinking about as you work through the budget process.
And the target from the co-chair's budget for OHA is $880 million below current service level.
Can you explain how the 3.7% general inflation rate is generated?
Office of Economic Analysis did some work around that. I think they look at CPI.
It comes out as part of the executive branch budget instructions. And I believe it's tied to CPI, but I don't know exactly.
It's quite a bit higher than CPI. I mean, I'm sure it's tied to CPI.
For 2 years.
For a two-year period, though.
Yeah, but still, that's...
If I can find something on the factors that went into it, but it's something that is there. They do some work on projections, and they may look at some specific elements like fuel and stuff as part of that conversation, as part of that discussion as well. There may be some specific inflationary factors that are addressed. I'll see if I can find something a little more detail on how that was developed. And then the next slide starts getting into some graphs that kind of show growth in current service level, and I think Linda is going
to... Yeah, back on that current service level slide, I did want to mention there's often confusion about the personal services costs. CSL includes the labor agreements and benefit costs, et cetera, that are already approved this biennium, and it simply biennializes it. So if you've had a COLA in the last 6 months, that cost is included for the whole 24 months. New labor negotiations or benefit increases are not in CSL, but money is set aside in what we call the salary pot, which is put in the E-fund, to pay for those costs that might come up during the next biennium. And there is a bit of a disconnect in that the legislature has to set aside or can choose to set aside this funding to cover those costs, but the executive branch is in charge of negotiating the costs.
So that inflation factor is, 1.6% over CPI. So, it's a substantial savings if we just use CPI as the inflation factor.
And it is significantly higher than it's been typically past biennia, so we'll check. In budgets like times like this, it's not uncommon for there to be a statewide adjustment to that inflation as part of how do we get out of the building with our last $30 million.
That's why I'm asking.
Nothing shall inflate.
Okay.
Oh.
So at this point, we're still on the statewide look. A bit later, we'll have a few of these similar graphs for human services. But the left bar shows where we're at in the current biennium, and then the taller bar shows the current service level for state. And this is just the general fund lottery. So you see the growth in that current service level statewide is about $3 billion. Or over 15% increase. That compares to resources only increasing about 6.5%. That's why we have such a gap. In terms of what the drivers of the increase are, you see position adjustments is a relatively small piece, but remember it's only state employees. So for instance, the increased cost of teachers in the state school fund, you'll see that in the big purple section for inflation, because all those special payments, even for K-12 where there is some explicit accounting for salary costs and benefit costs, it all goes out as special payments, so all those increases are show as inflation. And the other thing is on the replacing one-time funds, 19% of the increase or on a fairly big chunk of that. And when we look at human services, we'll see a much larger piece is that piece of the pie. And finally, the three ballot measures that passed this fall, if they were fully funded at estimated costs, is about $350 million or 12% of that increase. And this current service level included the ballot measures, which isn't technically current service level, but it is showing the total increased cost. Okay, on the next page.
Clarification. So that inflation factor, sorry to keep on, that is anticipating what negotiated pay increases will be?
For state employees, that's not in inflation.
So how do you calculate your projected labor costs? Are those already under active contract?
Those are under active.
It's that process I mentioned where we actually look at employee salaries and apply the COLA factor. We have a statewide system that captures all the positions in the state. It's actually position by position. It captures the value of the employee salary and includes that COLA and projects a cost. So it's not based on a percentage. It's based on a number in the system driving a total. Do you remember?
But that's going to be influenced by collective bargaining agreements.
So there's two separate things. Yeah. So CSO formulates what we know. Okay. Right? So everything that
what's
is in current
to?
Contracts, those are the things that are baked right. into the CSL. Then outside you have the salary pot, which is for if there are negotiations or things like that. They have this separate amount of money that kind of sits off to the side in the e-board, which then the executive branch then negotiates with that pot of money, which then we would then add that in. So, does that make sense?
Yeah.
And just in terms of the blocks for building CSL, those position actions for state employees are taken as a base adjustment when we actually look at the different pieces. Inflation is applied to services and supplies and then special payments.
The idea is in the CSL, we don't want to project what costs may or may not be. It's what we actually try and limit it to what we know. Right.
Okay. You want to flip it to the next one?
As best you can.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So here you see the kind of four data points we have. On the left is our current biennium budget, and then the CSL plus ballot measures is the second bar. It's that $3 billion increase that we just talked about. And then here we see the 17-19 governor's budget, which the blue is the general fund, and it's significantly below current service level. But what you see on the red is a lot of other funds that were used to replace general fund. So in the governor's budget, there's a little over $1 billion in new revenues. Some of those increased the general fund directly, but mostly they were other funds that then were used instead of general fund. So the governor is able to avoid a lot of program cuts by using these additional revenues. They included increase in tobacco tax, hospital assessments, insurance premium tax, use of the marijuana revenue to replace general fund. Those were some of the main ones. Then the co-chair budget, you see a little bit less general fund yet, and many fewer revenues. So in the co-chair budget includes significantly more program cuts because there are those fewer revenues. So now we switch over to a look at specifically at the human services program area. So you see, first of all, it's dominated by OHA and DHS. All those, the three little agencies, long-term care, blind commission, and PSRB, are in the other sliver that you can't really even see. And again, on the left, it's a general fund look. You see OHA and DHS are each about half of the program area budget. But in total funds on the right, OHA is much larger in total funds, 65% instead of 50. Two major reasons. There's more other fund revenues. Senator Winters have talked a little bit about. There's a significant amount of tobacco tax and the hospital assessment that are used in the health plan. But the biggest part of the story is federal funds. Federal funds have grown significantly in OHA since 2014, when Medicaid was expanded to include all adults under 138% of federal poverty level. And kind of just this reminds us in the human services, when we talk about budget reductions, there's always two parts of it. And for some programs, a fairly small reduction in state funding results in a very large reduction in federal funding. And it's often part of that conversation in deciding how do we reduce programs is looking at that total reduction in revenue that the program will receive.
Ms. Ames, question. On the tobacco tax, isn't that also one on the decline?
It is slight. I think it is slightly declining. So it is for the health plan. So there's two dynamics right now in the tobacco tax. There was a rate increase a couple years ago,
2013.
But a piece of the tobacco tax is now dedicated for mental health. So that means. So we had an increase from the rate increase. But now some of the money is going here, so the pieces of the money that are going to the health plan and the general fund, I believe, are now actually decreasing. And if they're not yet, they will be, because without another rate increase, the revenues will continue to decrease.
It points out one of the challenges with Pigovian taxes, right? Pigovian taxes are what most of us refer to as sin taxes, which is to say you impose a tax on behavior you don't want people to do, with the thought that you decrease people's utilization of those things or performance of those things that we want them to do, which is great, except that if you use that revenue to fund things that are critical to state government and then those revenues decline, which in essence you hope they will because fewer people are doing those things, then you're in something of a catch-22 situation, and it's a challenge that we face. There are a couple of, I know that, I mean, and our House colleague can probably tell us about this more than the Senate can because they start on your side. I know there are several tobacco tax proposals and an e-cigarette proposal on the table in the House this year. And the data are pretty clear that if you increase taxes on tobacco, you do decrease utilization, but unless you only increase them by a very small amount, you do also increase revenue. So tobacco taxes overall do increase revenue, but they may not be a steady long-term source, and in many ways you hope they aren't. So.
Okay. So here we look at the total funds budget for human services. On the left you see general fund about 20% of the pie and other funds about 20, with federal being about 60. And that little piece of lottery funds is the 1% of lottery funds that are dedicated for gambling addiction. It's the only lottery we have in this program area. And then, again, the same chart we saw statewide, now for human services, special payments here, even bigger piece, 82%, personal services at about 8%. And that's even though there are a lot of people in the human services program area. It's just that the special payments so much outweigh. So there's 12,400 FTE in this program area, about 8,000 in DHS, about 4,400 in OHA. Half of the staff in OHA are at the state hospital. So that's kind of where the people costs go.
Right. So in terms of the staff at OHA, half at the state hospital, the rest, are they more office-based people or direct service providers?
Next slide.
I think it might be on the next slide. I'm psychic that way.
Yeah. I'm trying to think where we actually would say we have direct service. There's very little direct service in OHA. There's a lot of people in the processing center, the call center, processing center for the health plan.
And that's in the health services division?
Yeah.
On that chart.
There's some direct service in public health. In that there's some, but typically public health works with counties, and a lot of the staff will be county level people, but there is a little bit of home visiting and some of that that's direct care in public health, but mostly it's more office based.
But we don't show in the state budget the positions that we fund, so we may send money to the county that runs their county health department, and we contribute a lot of that, but those FTEs
exactly
don't show in our
right.
Okay. Yeah.
Right.
But where they do show up is in the money that's in the grants that ends up funding those positions.
Right. And the biggest example of that, not in human services, but is the state school fund that funds right all the teachers and school staff, but there are no positions.
Okay.
I was going to actually skip the wall of numbers. I just put it in there so that you could see, if you wanted to look back, you can actually see by division in each agency what their budget looks like. You'll see things like in public health. There's very little general fund. It's all other funds and federal funds, even though it's a big amount. And as we actually go through budget materials, we're going to do it by division, so you're going to see the different looks, both the agency and when we do work sessions.
Wall of numbers, I like that.
I can't actually see it. This chart shows a little bit more detail by agency. So again, this is the general fund look. So you see in DHS, there's a big increase in CSL, 18%, $500 million. And in DHS, that's kind of spread across inflation, personnel costs, because of course they have lots of people, and caseload. It's kind of a mix of those three cost drivers. And then you see the governor's budget below that and the co-chair budget below that, each significantly less. In OHA, it's a little bit different story. So you see the current biennium, then you see that really big increase for current service level, 47% increase, $1 billion. Then, and on the next slide, we look a little bit more at the drivers of that, but go back for now. I'm just, sorry, I'm being confused. But a lot of that was related to replacing money we have now, but we don't have in the next biennium. Then you see the governor's budget was able to reduce general fund back a lot, all the way back to 15-17 level. And again, that was partly because she used a significant amount of other fund revenues, specifically in OHA, the tobacco tax, the insurance premium tax, and hospital assessments. So there, for instance, there are no benefit cuts in the health plan in the governor's budget. It's pretty hard to get to the co-chair budget level without having some benefit cuts. And then the co-chair budget, there's more general fund than the governor's budget, but significantly more program cuts. And again, that's related to the revenues that are in the governor's budget. And the next chart shows the same thing. And again, you see the all other on these. You can't even see. They're so tiny. The total funds are much more stable during the change between biennia and the different points. For DHS, a small increase in current service level. Actually, in OHA, the total funds decreases a little bit for current service level, and that's being driven by as the expansion population on the Oregon Health Plan is stabilizing now at a lower level than they have been during the last year and a half. And I think this is the last graph. I can't believe we actually are going to finish on time. So again, back to current service level growth in GF. This is like the earlier statewide graph, but just for human services. So you see that in really large current service level increase, over 30% and $1.5 billion increase. So $1 billion in OHA and $500 million in DHS. So if you start up position adjustments, the little blue slice, a piece of the increase, only 4%. So it isn't really being driven by personnel costs. Inflation is significant, as is caseload. Caseload is being driven more in Department of Human Services. Caseload growth for general fund in OHA is actually very modest the next biennium. I think it's only about $60 million. But the really big driver in this program area, and it's mostly all OHA, is replacing one-time revenues, or more broadly, replacing revenues we have now that we're not going to have next time. And those fall in three categories. The federal government gave us money for healthcare transformation over the last 5 years, actually, that now we're going to have to fund with general funds. And second, we had other fund revenues that we used in the current biennium that won't be around in 17-19 or will be at lesser levels. In particular, some hospital assessment revenue that was carried over from 13-15, some drug rebate revenues that we think were more one-time, and a portion of tobacco tax and the tobacco master settlement agreement, because, like we said, that's declining a bit. And then the other piece, the feds are paying a smaller portion of our programs next biennium than they are this time. So the state has to pay more to maintain those same benefits and population. The biggest piece of this is the phase-in of the expansion population. So the first 3 years after the ACA, the feds fully funded that population. But starting this year, in 17, the state has to pay 5%, and the federal government pays 95%. Then in 2018, the federal share goes down to 94%. 2019, it goes down to 93%. And then it jumps down to 90% thereafter. But we don't get to that until the 19-21 budget. But our regular match rate is also declining. We talked a little bit about that yesterday. That's for all our other populations. And that's the match rate that isn't set like this, like the feds have set the expansion population. It's a match rate that varies state to state a bit, depending on how your state is performing economically relative to other states. So between the two budgets, DHS and OHA, state costs increase $140 million just because of the change in that regular match rate. And all of that adds up to $872 million.
You know, I liken the state match rate to a catch-22. Because, you know, when we do well, and we have our performance means that we're getting healthier and some of those other issues, our rate goes down. Mm-hmm. You know, I've always questioned why the feds and how they do their calculations.
It's like the Medicaid geographic disparity in payments.
Yeah.
Oregon costs less.
It doesn't make sense to me, because we're always the one that gets our rates reduced.
Yep.
For doing a good job.
All right, well, that's the last slide, isn't it?
Yeah, that was a lot. That was 47 slides.
And we're quite a bit early than our 9:55 time frame. So any other questions or thoughts?
Sorry. I had a question on the transformation funding. If you read the 11:15 waiver A portion of it, which is quite lengthy, it talks about the community benefit providers, which we have a bill going to revenue in rather than coming to health care, in accommodating the concept of community benefit providers rather than having it in administration. We'll be looking at taking some of the administration costs and putting that cost towards the medical loss ratios in order to work with what that appendix says, the Title 21 funding. They lay that out in that policy, which is hundreds of pages, of around $180 million for 2017, $223 million for 2018. The federal government, through CMS response to our application for the 11:15 waiver amendment, capped the state's request at 5% for the community benefit type dollars. So that's written into the policy. Have we calculated that into our budget, or is this all still kind of a wait and see if those dollars actually come to pass and if we change our contracts with the CCOs to accommodate that waiver? Where is that conversation? It's very difficult. It's very complex.
I'll have to check. Yeah, I don't know. It isn't a part of the waiver that I'm aware of that could incur costs. And I mean, when I went through that, I sort of looked at it for an eye to where might we have increased costs that this would create. Because, of course, we didn't get any money with the waiver like we had initially hoped we would. Let me check on that. I don't really understand how that works.
Okay.
Do you think it's helpful to introduce Tamara, who's in the back of the room, since we'll be seeing a lot of her from CFO?
If you would like to do a professional bio introduction.
Well, not to that part.
Yeah.
I would just say, colleagues, in the back of the room in the corner in the red shirt is Tamara Brickman from the Chief Financial Officer's part of DAS, the Department of Administrative Services. We will be seeing a lot of Ms. Brickman, which is fortunate because she's an excellent analyst. And when we come in with agency presentations of various, we will be seeing her intermittently. So she's a very, very important part of our conversation. You'll remember Ms. Byerly talking to us about CFO's role in this, and we're very grateful to have her as part of our team. So I just wanted to point out, and a symbol of her excellence is the fact that she's sitting through this with all of us today. So thank you, Ms. Brickman. It's great to see you again.
Yeah. All right, so do we have other questions before we adjourn?
Maybe I will note that tomorrow the Oregon Health Authority will start with an overview by Director Saxton.
And the materials on OLIS for prompt meeting?
Her presentation materials are on OLIS, and then today I will be posting the LFO budget review documents, the short, you know, two pagers that are by division for OHA, and the agency has prepared what they call their ways and means reference document, which is sort of all the things that we ask for as part of ways and means, but that we may not have time to go over in detail in the actual agency presentations. And so, for instance, the other fund any balance report is in that document. So that'll all be out there on OLIS. It's a big document, but as well bookmarked. It's actually easier to use than you might imagine when you first see the size of the file.
And so tomorrow we'll start the formal committee process. And again, thank you guys for being here on time. We're going to try and start exactly at 8:30. I say that specifically for Dan Torres and Jonathan Eames in the audience who didn't show up again on time. So I appreciate everybody else that did show up on time. We'll go ahead and...
Just a minute, Mr. Chair. I don't mind picking on Torres and Eames because they deserve it. But... but I do think we need to remind the audience, for those who are listening, that it's perfectly acceptable to walk in and out of hearings because people do it all the time and they have multiple responses.
Why don't we change the paradigm here?
Did you really want to sit through this hearing if you were on the
I love this committee.
I know you do. I love this committee too. But all right, Mr. Chair, we're not going to get too far out of control here.
All right, with that said, we'll go ahead and adjourn.